Et quelqu'un, je dirais que c'est sans doute un des derniers de cette génération qui a connu les pères fondateurs de la physique quantique. Il a été l'élève de Werner Heisenberg, il a été l'élève de Wolfgang Pauli, qui a, comme vous savez, travaillé avec Jung sur la synchronicité en psychanalyse et en physique quantique. Et la synchronicité, c'est aussi la non-séparabilité quantique. C'est aussi la non-localité. Et donc, cet intervenant, Henri Stapp, a été chercheur et toujours au prestigieux Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, qui est un des grands centres de recherche de physique nucléaire aux États-Unis. Mais c'est aussi quelqu'un qui a travaillé pendant des années sur les questions de la conscience. Et c'est pour cela qu'il est ici aujourd'hui pour nous parler d'une vision du monde qui remet en cause justement ce matérialisme. Et donc, nous allons maintenant demander à Henri Stapp de venir nous rejoindre. Henri, bien, tu as tout. J'ai juste besoin de voir si la traduction est prête en cabine. C'est bon, ok, on y va. Henri, excuse.
For reading this talk. I have a lot of things I need to talk about efficiently, and this seemed to be the only way to do it. Quantum mechanics is a theory of conscious human beings and how we, by means of our conscious intentions, can influence our future. I shall explain how this works. I shall explain how this works. And we'll then argue that it is important for our joint well-being that we all become familiar with this quantum-based understanding of our own basic nature and of our place in the universe. Our presentation will deal in order with the following topics. First, promissory materialism. This idea is currently held by most neuroscientists. It says that dogged adherence to the principles of classical mechanics will ultimately lead to an understanding of consciousness. The second topic is Copenhagen quantum mechanics. This is the original version of quantum mechanics. It took the radical step of bringing conscious human experiences into basic physical theory. However, it did so in a way that did not provide a logically coherent understanding of reality. Von Neumann's orthodox interpretation. This is a reformulation of Copenhagen quantum mechanics that made it a rationally coherent theory of reality. The quantum Zeno effect. This is a mathematical property of orthodox quantum mechanics that allows our conscious intentions to influence our bodily actions. The non-material character of nature. Appearances are deceiving. The macroscopic world is not made of matter. It is made of potential experiences. This is what the theory says. And the sixth item is retrocausal effects. Recent experiments show directly at a macroscopic level certain retrocausal effects that are concordant with orthodox quantum mechanics, but are incompatible with materialist classical mechanics. This destroys the logical underpinnings of promissory materialism. I will conclude by showing how this leads to a rationally coherent quantum mechanical universe in which consciousness plays a fundamental role. I will then argue that wide dissemination of this quantum physics-based understanding of ourselves is important, both for our own personal well-being and for the welfare of our species. The question immediately before us is this: what is the nature of the connection between our conscious experiences and the physically described world? The classical physical theories that prevailed in science during the 18th and 19th centuries claimed that every physical property is predetermined by prior physical properties alone, with no added input from our conscious thoughts. That claim, if true, would make our lives meaningless. It would reduce each of us to an essentially mindless mechanical automaton that is unable to influence the course of future physical events for the benefit of either one's own self or for anyone else. Those classical physical theories are, however, now known to be fundamentally false. They have been replaced by quantum mechanics. In this new theory, our conscious free choices play an essential dynamical role in the future, in determining the future. These choices are called free because they are not constrained. I lost my voice, unfortunately. Okay, well,
try. Be listening in the room.
Est-ce qu'on peut mettre plus fort, s'il vous plaît?
Est-ce qu'en régie, on peut mettre le son plus fort, si c'est possible en régie? Non. Merci.
Maybe I'll just get closer to this mic. Does that help any? Those classical, those classical physical theories are, however, known to be fundamentally false. They have been replaced by quantum mechanics. In this new theory, our conscious free choices play an essential dynamical role in determining the future. These choices are called free because they are not constrained by any other feature of the theory, statistical or otherwise. The direct physical effect of these choices lies in our brains. That's in this orthodox theory. This focus on the mind-brain connection brings us to topic number one, promissory materialism. Sir Karl Popper is generally regarded as one of the greatest philosophers of science of the 20th century. He refers to the theory of the mind-brain connection currently being pursued by mainstream neuroscience as promissory materialism. The promise is the dogged adherence to the principles of classical mechanics will eventually produce an understanding of consciousness. The daunting challenge to promissory materialism was eloquently described by the great 19th century physicist John Tyndall. Quote, "We can trace the development of a nervous system and correlate it with a parallel phenomena of sensation and thought. We see with undoubting certainty that they go hand in hand, but we try to soar in a vacuum the moment we seek to comprehend the connection between them. Man as object is separated by an impassable gulf from man as subject. There is no motor energy in intellect to carry it without logical rupture from one to the other." I have the Syrac for the translators, and the page is out of order. It's an important page, the next sentence is. You can have a translator read it for me. They probably have it. What's that? No. The translator wanted a copy. They zeroed it.
Number five.
I should have checked it first. Totally missing. No. There it is. Tyndall's impassable gulf was, however, bridged by the great 20th century logician John von Neumann. But his achievement was based on replacing the principles of class mechanics by those of quantum mechanics. This brings us to topic number two, which is Copenhagen quantum mechanics. Early in the 20th century, a series of experimental and theoretical findings showed that the classical principles that work so well for large astronomical and terrestrial objects failed to work for the atomic constituents of those objects. A new set of laws was found to hold at the level of the atoms. These laws apply, in principle, not just to individual atoms, but also to systems consisting of arbitrarily large numbers of atoms. However, if we try to apply these laws to a system consisting of the atomic constituents of both an observing person and a system that he or she is observing, then we find that what the observer experiences is very different from what the theory predicts. By virtue of the atomic laws, the brain of the observer often evolves into a mixture of many different states, each of which corresponds to a different perception. Yet only one of these perceptions occurs in any actual empirical instance. Consequently, the theory understood in the ordinary traditional way fails to agree with experience. The founders of quantum theory resolved this conflict between theory and experience by abandoning the conceptual framework that Isaac Newton had created in the 17th century. That classical way of thinking had, for more than two centuries, been accepted by scientists as the proper foundation of science, but it excluded, as a matter of principle, any causal participation of our conscious experiences in the unfolding of the physically described future. Quantum theory revokes that exclusion. It elevates our conscious experiences from passive witnesses to active participants in the creation of our common future. To understand this profound change in science's conception of us human beings and of the world in which we're embedded, it is helpful to review how this radical revision came about. To cope with the puzzling 20th century findings, the founders of quantum theory emphasized that science must be anchored in what we know. But everything we know resides in our experience. The founders therefore backed away from the idea that the aim of science was to comprehend the reality that lies behind our experiences. They focused instead on the structure of these experiences themselves. In the words of Niels Bohr, quote, "In our description of nature, the purpose is not to disclose the real essence of phenomena, but only to track down as far as possible relations between the multifold aspects of our experience." Quantum theory was, therefore, unquote, quantum theory was, therefore, originally offered not as a theory of reality, as defined in some abstract classical sense, it was presented rather as a practical tool for making predictions about our future experiences on the basis of information derived from our past experiences. You see, it's all about experience. Our human experiences thereby became the basic realities of the theory, and that's what the theory was all about. We observers were conceived of in accordance with our own intuitive understanding of ourselves as psychophysical beings that can first form value-based intentions about how best to act, and can then act in accordance with that mentally chosen intention. This change violates the core idea of classical mechanics. It injects into the workings of nature certain human conscious choices that within the quantum mechanical framework are not controlled by the mechanical aspects of the theory or by anything else in the theory. They're called free choices. There's nothing in the theory that determines what they're going to be. These free choices are introduced into the practically useful theory as the experimenter's choices of which probing actions he or she will perform. These free choices are not introduced in order to accommodate our intuitions about ourselves. They play an essential technical role. Each such choice picks out, in a way not determined by anything in the theory, some particular possible experience from a continuum of possibilities. A pause is needed here. A huge conceptual leap has been made, and important things will follow from it. Some serious reflection is in order. Classical mechanics grew out of our observations of large astronomical and terrestrial bodies. In such cases, our choices of what to attend to has little or no effect on the system being observed. But is it reasonable to conclude from those cases that a person's mental choice of what personal body action to attend to has little or no effect on that person's bodily action? The answer clearly is no. The fact that motions of planets do not depend on what questions we choose to ask about those motions need not carry over to the questions we choose to ask about the motions of our own bodies. Quantum mechanics is far better suited than classical mechanics to deal with this, with the causal effects of our probing minds on what we are probing. The general logical form of the quantum mechanical probing procedure is this. The observer chooses and then performs an action such that if the chosen experiential response, he's picked an experience he's focusing on and asked, am I going to experience this? If the chosen experiential response to that probing action actually occurs, then the system being observed acquires an associated physical property. Nature responds by either making the chosen experience occur or not, in accordance with a quantum statistical rule. An absolutely key feature of this probing procedure is that this observed property is something that the observed system might possess after the probing process is completed, but may not have possessed before the process was initiated. For example, the state of an observed system before the observation might be represented by a physical state spread out over a large spatial region, whereas after a positive response, the state might be confined to a tiny region. Such a collapse of the quantum state provides a resolution of the wave particle duality problem. But this theory has certain difficulties that were resolved by von Neumann's orthodox quantum mechanics. The clock's idea was resolved by official edict, the wave-particle duality problem, but it raised many other problems. The founders dodged these. Something wrong? What? Close to the mic? But it raised many other puzzles. The founders dodged them by claiming to provide only a practical tool. But the brilliant logician John von Neumann faced the puzzles head on. The original Copenhagen way of describing the collapse process was tied to a mysterious thing called the Heisenberg cut. Everything below this cut was supposed to be described in the mathematical language of quantum mechanics, whereas everything above the cut was described either in the language of classical physics or in psychological or mental terms. The idea here was that a practical account must accommodate our mental intentions and free choices, and also our descriptions of, in Bohr's words, what we have done and what we have learned. Those things were described in mental and classical terms, whereas their atomic underpinnings were described in terms of the quantum mathematics. This Heisenberg cut was movable. Its placement depended on what practical use was to be made of the theory. But that movability meant that the same physical thing could be described in two logically incompatible ways, either classically or quantum mechanically, depending on the practical application. Such an inconsistency might be all right for a purely practical theory, but it is not acceptable for a putative description of reality itself. A principal move made by von Neumann was to show that the problematic second physical description occurring in the Copenhagen formulation, namely the classical description, could be removed without changing the predictions of the theory. The mentally described experiences were kept fixed, while the Heisenberg cut was moved up step by step until all physically described things lie below the cut, and hence are described in the mathematical language of quantum mechanics. The second physical description, in terms of the concept of the false classical mechanics, were thereby eliminated. Each observer's mental aspects are preserved during this shift of the cut, but they are eventually pushed completely out of the physical world. These preserved mental aspects were called abstract egos by von Neumann. They are mental in character and are separated from the physical world. Yet each such ego retains a dynamical linkage to an associated physical brain. Thus Tyndall's impassable gulf between man and object and man as subject has been bridged by rigorous quantum mathematics. Von Neumann converted what was originally offered as a mere practical tool into a rationally coherent putative description of a dynamically integrated psychophysical reality. Von Neumann's work, by eliminating the problematic classical description, eliminates also the notion that mere bigness can cause a collapse. After all, how big is big? Von Neumann's formulation ties the collapse not to something as nebulous as big, but rather to something that, according to the theory, is separate from the physical world, namely our consciousness. This theory specifies the place where the consciousness acts, namely in the brain of the observer. But how does this action help us to do what we want to do? It helps us via the quantum Zeno effect. It might seem that a mere capacity to pose questions and register answers would leave our egos just as helpless and impotent as before. But the quantum mechanical process of posing questions and receiving responses is not like the classical mechanical process in which the observer is merely a witness. In quantum mechanics, the observer's free choice of which question to ask plays a critical role in determining which properties will manifest themselves. In quantum mechanics, the observer asks nature a yes-no question about the state of a system. If nature's response is yes, then after this response, the system will definitely have the property that the observer free picked. In general, this dependence, the properties of the system being probed upon the observer's free choice of question, that the properties after the probing process, depends upon the observer's free choice of question, does not give the observer any effective control of the observed system. That is because nature's response can be no. However, there's an important situation in which, according to the quantum rules, the no answers will be strongly suppressed. In that case, the free choices made by an observer can exert effective control over the system being probed, which in von Neumann's theory is the brain of the observer. Suppression of the no responses is predicted if an initial yes response is followed by a sufficiently rapid sequence of posing of the same question. In that case, the observer, no answers get suppressed. In that case, the observer becomes empowered by his own free choices to hold stable in place a chosen brain process that normally would quickly fade away. This effect is the celebrated quantum Zeno effect, which was linked by Siddharshan and Misra to the paradox of the arrow in flight posed by the great philosopher Zeno of Elea. This important dynamical change in the role of us observers was repeatedly emphasized by Bohr and the other founders in statements such as, in, quote, this is Bohr, in the great drama of human existence, we are both actors and spectators. This change vindicates William James's commitment to reality. He says, quote, it is to my mind utterly inconceivable that consciousness should have nothing to do with a business which it so faithfully attends. All this is tied to the basic property called the non-material nature of nature. The question naturally arises why most neuroscientists interested in mind-brain connection choose to ignore this theory that is so perfectly suited to their needs. One reason, of course, is the power of inertia and authority. Another is the unfamiliar mathematics. More important is the fact that physics textbooks follow the pragmatic Copenhagen attack, in which the quantum collapses are imagined to occur at external measuring devices rather than in our brains. But probably the most important inhibitor is the fact that the orthodox theory entails that the seeming validity of classical ideas at the level of visible size properties is illusory. Problem here. 17 is missing. There it is. Very good. Appearances are deceiving. They are, in fact, profoundly deceiving. In the Orthodox theory, the physically described world is considered to be fully quantum mechanical. That means that, in spite of its classical appearance, the macroscopic properties of the world is considered to be, the macroscopic physical world is considered to be a bundle of potentialities pertaining to what might appear if someone actually looks. Let me just say that again. This means that in spite of classical appearances, the macroscopic physical world is considered to be a bundle of potentialities pertaining to what might appear if someone actually looks. So you see all throughout the writings of Heisenberg and many others that somehow what was the physical world that seemed to be so material in character has dissolved into this system of potentialities. And these potentialities are potentialities for possible experiences. So the whole thing is moving in the realm of experience. The normally observed classical appearance of the visible world you see around us here is, according to the Orthodox theory, created at least in part by all of the observations that have been made over the course of the history of the universe. Those conditions are very restrictive, but they still allow a lot of quantum mechanical uncertainty for perceivable sized things that are not actually perceived. Our brains, for example, are highly quantum mechanical. Large amounts of quantum uncertainty are introduced by the passage of ions through ion channels. For those of you who don't know, there are these large molecules with a little channel through them in your brain through which calcium ions and other ions flow. So we're talking about those ion channels here. The small spatial diameters of these channels entail large uncertainties in the velocities of the ions that are emerging from the channels. That's the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics. Calculations reveal this is a very big effect. A living person's brain is, therefore, a generator of huge amounts of quantum mechanical uncertainty. This uncertainty can percolate up to a macroscopic level without being perceived, either by the person himself or by anyone else. Brains must, therefore, be treated quantum mechanically. That permits the behavior of a person's brain to be significantly influenced by the free choices made by that person's conscious mind. So I'm saying here, you do the calculations, you find that there is ample room for the uncertainty that you needed. This brain, although it looks like it's a classical thing, is really highly quantum mechanical in nature. Weird as this quantum mechanical feature might seem to scientists steeped in Newtonian physics, it is where quantum mechanics rationally leads. It is also concordant with our experience-based understanding of our own nature. And it is in line with a certain idea of parsimony that would not allow nature to encumber itself with a highly developed consciousness that cannot make any difference in what actually happens. The fundamentally non-material character of the quantum mechanical world is, at the macroscopic level, is entailed by what Einstein called its spooky action at a distance. This basic feature of quantum mechanics involves the need for faster-than-light transfer of information. Einstein believed that this essential feature of quantum mechanics was somehow just an aspect of the mathematical formalism that could not be property of the basic underlying reality. However, it has been rigorously proved that quantum mechanics has a purely macroscopic, faster-than-light property that is incompatible with the no-faster-than-light property entailed by the principles of classical mechanics, of relativistic classical mechanics. So, this idea of faster-than-light action distance is something that you cannot avoid, and in fact, you can prove it even in situations that deal with nothing but macroscopic, visible-sized things. Just within that framework alone, you can prove that there must be faster-than-light action at a distance. So, of course, the bottom line right there means this idea of material universe, where everything has to be carried by matter moving at the speed of light, is just not compatible with the experiments. The sixth of the points that I wanted to make is some certain experiments called retrocausal effects. Quite apart from the logical proofs that I just talked about, there are also directly observable phenomena involving the appearance of backward in time action. The quantum collapses have a certain kind of quasi-retrocausal action. These collapses I'm going to describe this quasi-local action. Let me say, because of things you've heard this morning, that this orthodox quantum mechanical interpretation is described in space-time, in ordinary four-dimensional space-time. I'm not worrying about gravity now, but apart from gravity, in ordinary four-dimensional space-time by a generalization of the instant now. How much time do I have? In non-relativistic quantum mechanics, these collapses of the wave function occurred at a constant time. Over here something happened, and it would cause this collapse of the wave function to occur over the entire universe at this instant of time. And that's where the faster-than-light action distance comes from. So that was non-relativistic quantum mechanics, but relativistic quantum field theory has a generalization of that, which I have a minute, I think I can describe it. Instead of having a flat surface, you have kind of a wiggly surface. It's called a space-like surface because it's no two points on this surface can be connected to each other by something that travels at the speed of light. So it means that it's kind of flattish. It doesn't go like this, but nonetheless there can be all sorts of wiggles in it. And the way this nature's process of advancing into the future proceeds in the relativistic version is that you have these space-like surfaces, and then there's a little advance here, and then a little advance here, and a little advance here. So the whole thing is solidly situated in four-dimensional space-time with the idea of advancing into the future in a strictly causal way, with the true advances being only into the future. So it's relativistic, and this is the foundation of relativistic quantum field theory, it's nonetheless solidly embedded in space-time. Now, I'll read this now, tie what I just said into what I'm going to read. Quite apart from logical proofs, there are also directly observable phenomena, appearances, involving appearances of backward-in-time action. I've just said, there's no backward time action, but there's something that looks like it. The quantum collapses have a certain kind of quasi-retrocausal action. These collapses, and this is a kind of amazing thing, but it's how it works. Mathematics is unmistakable. These quantum collapses not only pick out what actually happens from a set of potentialities for what might happen, they also eliminate from the records of the past all traces of properties that led to the possibilities that were eliminated by nature's choice. So, here we have the surface. There's a little advance here. Before the advance, there were all these potentialities advancing into the future here. And then here, there was a choice that was made, and something that could have happened didn't happen. And other things did happen. That's the nature's choice, besides what eliminates a lot of things that not happen. But the mathematics also says that if you look after this thing has happened to the records of the past, you will find that there's no record of anything that led to what didn't happen. The only records that are left are records that lead to what did happen. So, although the process is fully forward in time, because the records, if you look at it after the thing has happened and look at the past, you only see the processes that lead up to what actually did happen. These surviving records of the physical processes leading up to the collapse event reveal only those parts of the past that lead up to what actually did happen. The other parts disappear without a trace. As Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow succinctly put it in their recent book, The Grand Design, we create history rather than history creating us. We are creating. We make a choice, something happens, and then after this happens, you look back at the past, and what you see in the past depends on what you chose to ask and what nature chose to make actual. So even though the whole process is strictly forward time causal, there is this kind of miraculous looking backward time action. We create history by our observations rather than history creating us. A large number of experiments have confirmed various empirical consequences of this retrocausal action directly at the macro level of perceivable sized effects. Let me read that again because I mumbled a little bit. A large number of experiments have confirmed various empirical consequences of this quantum retroaction directly at the macro level of perceivable sized effects. One example is the contraction of the pupil of a person's eye, period. The pupil contracts slightly before a randomly timed light flashes. As you know, when the light flashes, your pupil contracts. But what they find is that they have quantum random number generators that's going to say what time the light is going to flash. And these are experiments that are, I've been getting letters about these things for quite a few years now, maybe 8 or 9 years. I never quite believed it, but before I came to this conference, I Googled it. In fact, you can Google it yourself. Look under pupil dilation, retrocausation. And there have been a huge number of these experiments performed now, and statistics is just huge that this is a real effect. And So, again, that's something that's totally compatible with the idea that the world is operating according to the principles of relativist classical mechanics. Another kind of experiment, which has a longer history, 1 minute, 2 minutes, has to do with skin conductance. As you know, when you get an emotional response, your skin conductance, you sweat. And in these cases, the subject is suddenly hit with some, you're looking at pictures and suddenly a gory picture appears before you. But just before the picture appears, you already have, you start to sweat. And just solid evidence that it can't be, the world cannot be classical. And conclusion. The failure of classical mechanics at the level of the atoms led to its replacement by quantum mechanics. But that change alters the behavior of all systems. Well, I have 1 minute and a half. of all systems composed of atoms. This includes our brains, which generally become mixtures of states corresponding to different perceptions. That mind-brain disparity caused the founders of quantum mechanics to bring our conscious experiences into the theory as independent variables, not mere restatements of physical properties. The core problem of understanding nature thus becomes focused on the connection between our minds and our brains. Quantum mechanics provides us a conceptual foundation very well suited to studying this problem of the effects of actions of the probing mind upon the brain that is being probed, whereas classical mechanics, with its materialistic conception of us, does not. Scientifically validated conception does not. Just one half a minute, and that is the point that this false perception of ourselves, or conception of ourselves, generated by classical mechanics, or we're some sort of mechanical machine, is a very corrosive feature of our thought process. We consider ourselves, at least all of the authorities are telling us, our teachers, and all of the most of the scientists are telling us that you're a robot. And the government authorities and officials and all these people are going along with nature, when along with science, they think, by furthering this idea that we're robots. And I think it's an important thing that the record should be straight here. Science does not say that at all. And I think it would be a far better thing if everybody began to understand that. Thank you.
Alors, comme vous l'avez vu, tout ceci... Comme vous l'avez vu, cela tournait autour des deux grands mystères de la physique quantique. Le mystère de la non-localité, qu'on a largement vu ce matin, et le mystère de la réduction du paquet d'ondes, ce qui rend justement cette équation, on a parlé des équations de Schrödinger, une équation... qui décrit le fonctionnement d'une onde, et puis il y a cette réduction du paquet d'ondes, il y a ce collapse. Et donc tout le problème, effectivement, est à quoi est dû ce collapse et comment relie-t-on ceci à la conscience. Une des choses dont il a beaucoup parlé, qu'il a appelé le backward causation in time, on pourrait dire le choix retardé, pour le comprendre, il faut imaginer l'expérience suivante. Il a beaucoup hésité, il a demandé si ce n'était pas une vraie action dans le passé. Et à la fois, c'est une sorte d'action dans le passé. Voilà l'exemple d'une expérience. Imaginez, vous savez, il y a ce qu'on appelle des mirages gravitationnels à cause de la déformation de l'espace-temps. Vous avez une galaxie, derrière il y a une autre galaxie, et ici il y a la Terre. Nous regardons ces deux galaxies l'une derrière l'autre. Les images de la galaxie la plus lointaine passent à droite et à gauche de la galaxie qui est devant. Vous voyez, donc on a une image fantôme. On voit une image à droite de la galaxie, une image à gauche de la galaxie, mais c'est les deux images de la même galaxie qui en fait est située derrière la première. Ça s'appelle un mirage gravitationnel, c'est très connu, c'est une conséquence de la relativité d'Einstein, du fait que les masses déforment l'espace-temps. Maintenant, imaginez qu'en laboratoire, on recombine les faisceaux de lumière qui viennent de l'image de droite de la galaxie et de l'image de gauche de la galaxie. C'est-à-dire, il y a des rayons lumineux qui venant de la galaxie la plus lointaine sont passés certains à droite, certains à gauche, d'accord ? On les met dans le laboratoire et on les recombine de telle façon qu'on puisse faire dans le laboratoire le choix. Est-ce que la particule de photon, la particule de lumière qu'on a en laboratoire, est passée par la droite ou est-ce qu'elle est passée par la gauche? Le problème, c'est que ça fait 3 milliards d'années que la particule est passée à droite ou que la particule est passée à gauche si la galaxie est à 3 milliards d'années-lumière, vous voyez? C'est ça l'idée du backward causation in time, c'est ça l'idée de l'expérience à choix retardé qui a été mise au point par un des plus grands physiciens de la physique quantique qui s'appelle Wheeler. Et donc c'est ça dont nous a parlé Henri en grande partie, et un de ses arguments était de dire, bon, ça c'est pas une vraie action dans le passé, mais il y a comme quelque chose qui est intemporel. Et donc ce quelque chose, c'est le lien qu'il a fait avec l'esprit, en fait c'est pour ça qu'il a cité aussi John von Neumann, qu'on a déjà cité à plusieurs reprises avec André Grimm, qui était le plus grand théoricien parmi ceux, il y en a d'autres, London, Bauer et d'autres, qui disent qu'effectivement, eh bien, étant donné que les particules et même les atomes de notre cerveau obéissent aux lois quantiques, il faut quelque chose d'autre qui fasse la différence, et que ce quelque chose, c'est la conscience quand elle se manifeste. Donc c'était un certain nombre d'arguments, il a avancé d'autres arguments après, plus de façon, il a dit que ça le rendait nerveux, c'était plus proche, on va dire, un peu de la parapsychologie, avec l'idée que la personne, par exemple, cligne des yeux, alors qu'elle va recevoir un flash dans les yeux, le problème c'est que ce flash dans les yeux est généré par un générateur aléatoire qui décide aléatoirement du moment où on envoie le flash. Et que dans certains cas, eh bien, le flash, on peut coordonner, montrer que le flash apparaît, le clignement d'œil apparaît juste avant le flash, alors que la génération du flash est en théorie aléatoire. Donc il a essayé d'accumuler des arguments de ce type pour montrer qu'effectivement, l'hypothèse, il a d'abord parlé, tout le monde a parlé ici de l'interprétation de Copenhague, qui vous dit en gros, comme on a dit ce matin, tais-toi et calcule. Il n'y a pas besoin d'expliquer la nature des choses, on est pragmatique. Si on veut expliquer la nature des choses, on doit rentrer dans une vision non matérielle du monde, une vision où la conscience joue un rôle, et c'est ce que Henri a essayé, je crois, de nous démontrer. Donc maintenant, nous allons passer à une autre intervention d'une autre personnalité américaine, quelqu'un qui n'est pas venu en France depuis 40 ans, et quand il est venu en France, il a fait une conférence de physique nucléaire tout à fait classique, donc ce sera sa première conférence de cette nature. C'est quelqu'un qui est interviewé dans un film très connu, beaucoup d'entre vous ont vu, What's the Big Do We Know. C'est aussi quelqu'un sur lequel il y a un film en vente ici par Jupiter Film, qui est un des partenaires de cette manifestation, et Diane Roloff, que je salue, qui s'appelle l'activiste quantique, donc ça veut tout dire. C'est quelqu'un de très, je crois, positif, au sens de la psychologie positive. Nous allons maintenant écouter donc Amit Goswami, que j'invite à nous rejoindre. Est-ce que la vidéo fonctionne sur le canal? Oui, c'est parfait. So, oops. You need some water? It's okay? You don't need water? Okay. So, that's it. Yes, 45 minutes, absolutely. Good. Okay. So, that's it. So, this way to go on. And this way to go, okay, and this is the pointer.
Okay. Good afternoon. My task is very simple. All day, I think you were listening to the presentations in a somewhat formal way, which is the physicist way, scientific way. And I have been very pleased that you have been patient with that. But look, I will simplify all this very much. So if any doubts remain that consciousness does matter, those doubts should resolve now, I hope. Now, many things have been presented, so I will assume a little bit of those presentations making a mark on you. Fundamentally, quantum objects are waves of possibility. What does that tell us? That tells us that since we don't observe possibilities in the manifest world, quantum physics unequivocally tells us that there are two realms of reality. One is the domain of potentiality, potentia, and the other is the manifest domain. Now you have to understand that this is very good news. This is the third time in human history, because in spiritual traditions, they have been talking about something called transcendent domain, quote unquote, and an immanent domain, or popular names, heaven and earth, for millennia. So they have known about these two domains, and how did they know? Well, experientially. They found that the transcendent domain has a wholeness, and if you can identify with that wholeness, then all suffering disappears. Now, this is very interesting, because a part of our experiences then, if we could understand it, are such that it could resolve suffering in a very general way. Now, what is also very interesting is that to the tail end of 19th century, Sigmund Freud discovered a very similar thing, but he is not talking about grandiose suffering. He is talking about ordinary psychological suffering that we call pathology. He discovered that some of the pathological behavior is due to another domain of reality that he called unconscious. And then the distinction of unconscious and conscious. And what is very interesting is that Freud also was very clear. This unconscious affects the conscious. So some of the behavior of the conscious appears weird, appears neurotic. Quantum physics, another few decades, discovered the same thing. Once again, third time. Unmanifest possibilities become manifest actualities, but the possibility determined actuality. It's not that they're independent realities. So pretty much the idea that is coming to you is that contrary to what scientific materialists believe, there really are two domains of reality. Three times should be the charm. How many times do we have to discover the will before the classical scientists agrees that there are two domains of reality? Now, the second thing that needs to be emphasized. Is that the two domains are separated by discontinuity. There are certain principles as you go along that quantum physics will give us, and you will be better off remembering these principles, because these principles are part of the forgetfulness of the classical scientists. We want to bring them back in order to live in a quantum mechanical way, which is what our experiences demand from us. We got to learn these basic quantum principles as they're different from the classical principles. Classical physics, everything is continuous. In quantum physics, there's fundamental discontinuity, which Niels Bohr first suggested when he said that electrons, when they jump from one orbit to another, never go through the intervening space. Now, what is very important is that all transitions between the possibility realm and the actuality realm similarly are discontinuous transitions. In other words, you cannot reach outside of space and time in a continuous way. So, we have to become aware of it. Why? Because if we want to access this domain, we have to become aware that there are certain barriers, conceptual barriers that arise. We cannot expect to reach this consciousness, transcendent consciousness, in a continuous way, if this domain of potential indeed is domain of consciousness. Now, okay, this, okay, why not explain that? No, I want to show you another picture first. Let's very simply try to understand what previous speakers have all said, how consciousness enters physics. And how consciousness enters physics in a very compulsory way. After you go through this argument, which is just a simplified version of what various speakers already have presented, you will have no doubt. So how does the proof go? This is the ordinary reductionistic picture of the scientific materialist. Everything is made of elementary particles. Elementary particles make atoms, make molecules, all the way to the brain, to consciousness. Consciousness is brain phenomenon. That is the general understanding of neurophysiology. However, put it in quantum language, possible elementary particles make possible atoms, make possible molecules, make possible neurons, make possible brain, makes what? Possible consciousness, possible observer. And then possible observer looks at a possible elementary particle and you get actuality. You have to believe that. Possibility coupled to possibility only gives possibility. This is what is called von Neumann's theorem. A little bit more sophisticated version of it is that no material interaction can ever change possibility into actuality. Repeat that. No material interaction can ever change possibility, quantum possibility, into actual events of experience. What does that tell you? There has to be a non-material entity. But of course, this non-material entity, if we call it consciousness, this non-material entity cannot be dualistic. This we have heard again and again. Dualism produces all kinds of problems, energy conservation being one of them. There is no signal exchange, because if there were, energy of the physical world alone could not be conserved, could not be a constant. So how does consciousness, if it is consciousness that we are talking about, how does consciousness resolve this possibility-actuality transition? Well, consciousness does it by choosing. Choosing from what? Choosing from its own possibility. This is the crucial concept that has to be understood. In other words, this domain of reality that we have been calling potentia, which we have called non-local, this is already familiar to you from various talks. This non-local domain of reality, if we call it consciousness, it's an all-engulfing reality. It includes everything, includes materiality itself. Material possibilities are possibilities of this consciousness. Once we comprehend this, then of course there is no more dualism. In other words, another way of putting it is that consciousness is the ground of all being in which matter exists as possibilities. Consciousness chooses among the material possibilities to make the actual experience. What is the proof of it? Non-locality, right? If there is non-locality, then this picture is valid. If there is non-locality in the submicroscopic domain, which of course various speakers already have talked about, that is already a proof for a non-local consciousness. But what is very wonderful is that we now have macroscopic proof, and that proof is the That proof is what is shown here. I'll describe this briefly because I think this is the most convincing experiment at present. Replicated some 24 times, but first done by Jacobo Greenberg Zilberbaum at the University of Mexico, a neurophysiologist. What he did was let two people meditate together for 20 minutes. After the meditation, with the intention that they will have this direct non-local communication, after the meditation, they were separated, but they're still holding the intention of having non-local communication. They are separated, put into two independent Faraday chambers. electromagnetical impervious zones. Both brains are now connected to electroencephalogram machines. One of the subjects is shown a series of light flashes, typically 100. And that subject's EEG, of course, records the brain waves. The electrical activity is natural, and the brain waves are treated with noise elimination, and a signal is extracted, and that signal is what you see in the upper curve. The second subject has not seen any light flashes, and still, his or her brain waves are also examined, noise eliminated, and then a signal is extracted, and look at the two signals, how close they are. But one is evoked. One is from a subject who has seen light flashes. The other one must be transferred, because the other one has not seen any light flashes at all. How are they connected? They are connected by meditative intention, something that mystics have told us that that might be able to connect us, but we never expected to see this kind of experiment in our lifetime, did we? If the experiment is done with controlled subjects, people who cannot meditate or did not meditate, then we never get this transfer potential. Look, there is no transfer potential, and there is transfer potential. Meditation produces non-local correlation or entanglement between subjects. Consciousness is non-local. That's the connection between the two. So we have this interconnectedness that we call consciousness. So in this way, consciousness enters physics in a very solidly radical way. Then what do we do from there? How do we apply this to our regular day-to-day life, to our psychological experience, where we not only experience matter as sensing, but we also experience feelings, we experience thinking, we experience even intuition. All these experiences frame our life. In scientific materialism, there is no way of giving any value to these experiences, other than that material sensing experience. In this way, we have shortchanged ourselves, because much of our life centers around what we experience in our psyche, the inner domain of our lived reality. How do we expand this indeed? We expand it by suggesting that not only matter, but also mind, but also a body that we can call a vital body of feelings, from which our feelings come from, and even a supramental, supravital body from which our intuitions come from. So in other words, we say that why should just material possibilities be part of consciousness? Let's generalize. Consciousness consisting of four kinds of world of possibilities, all in potential, all in that transcendent domain of reality. But consciousness having four worlds of possibilities, a world of physical, a world of vital, a world of mental, and a world of supramental intuitions, this now prepares the room for a science of all of our experiences. This should be the basis of psychology, because psychologists have been talking to us about these experiences. Carl Jung, in fact, found that indeed there are people for whom the physical experiences take a secondary role than their thinking mind. And there are even people for whom feelings are very important. And Carl Jung found that even there are people for whom intuitions play the crucial role of their personality. So that being the case, if we ignore anything except the physical, we'll be shortchanging ourselves to no end. This just cannot go on. If we accept that this is the way it is, we first of all have to look at, okay, do we really need a mind which is non-material, which is independent of matter? Do we really need the postulate of a vital body, which biologists have discarded ever since molecular biology came along in the 1950s? And of course, intuition is still debated among erudite pundits. So the first thing to do is to convince ourselves that mind has something that matter cannot do. Now this proof also has come along. This is why I have that picture, television picture. Roger Sperry used to say that all you have to do to discover the mind is look at a television set. It's a play of electron on the body of the television, on the screen. Physical rules and laws can tell you everything about the movement of the electrons. But can they tell you about the meaning of the pictures that you are seeing? No. So Roger Sperry's point was that mind gives meaning, and we need, therefore, a non-material mind. But is it true that computers cannot process meaning? That proof had to wait till Roger Penrose did a very good job following up an idea by John Searle, the philosopher, that indeed, this is using the very famous Gödel's theorem, indeed, a computer can never process meaning. Meaning cannot be processed in a rational way. Now you can interpret that and say there's a non-rational component in the brain, but I think the best way of doing this is to say that mind is non-material. Mind processes meaning. Why do we need the vital body? This was found by Rupert Sheldrake, who was studying morphogenesis, biological form making. And Rupert found that if you want to explain cell differentiation properly, it requires the concept of non-locality. But material bodies can never have non-local interactions, therefore Rupert said that, okay, there must be morphogenetic fields. What are they? Morphogenetic fields are blueprints of biological form. That's the best way of thinking about them. So when consciousness makes biological form, consciousness collapses not only the physical form, but also the morphogenetic blueprints of form that come with it. So this movement of the blueprints of form, movements of the morphogenetic field, that is what we experience as feeling. So this is just a general picture of what we are saying. Consciousness collapses by choosing. Consciousness collapses by choosing from four worlds of experience. When we choose from the physical, we get sensing. When we choose from the vital, we get feeling. When we choose from the mental world, we get thinking. When we choose from the supramental, archetypal world, Plato's term, we get intuition. This is the picture. A very, very important part of the picture, of course, is that this picture now should explain the other very dominant experience that we have, besides experiencing these contents, thoughts, feelings, sensing, and intuition. We have one other very dominant aspect of our consciousness, which is the feeling of the experience of I, subject. Every one of us, amazingly, has a subject looking at the world of objects. Where does the subject come from? If you look at this problem of subject-object split, and if you are a scientific materialist, you would go crazy, unless you know how to put your head under the sand like an ostrich. Because if you build your world with objects, objects making bigger objects, and if the brain was like that, then you could never have a subject. Subject is qualitatively different from an object. Where does the subject come from? This is a question that scientific materialism just cannot answer. Sometimes this is called the hard question of neurophysiology. But it's really the impossible question of neurophysiology. Henry mentioned professor of materialism, that's what you have to do in order to answer such questions. What is the answer? The answer that is given from quantum mechanical considerations is quite straightforward. Brain must be very special. Because look, Henry already did a good analysis of this, so I won't go belabor too much, but it's already very clear that a normal measurement apparatus that physicists use, that is still a quantum mechanical machine, still a possible machine. But as soon as brain enters the picture, and notice that it always enters the picture, because quantum collapse can occur only in the presence of the observer. Therefore, observer's brain is always there. It's the final piece of the machinery, if you believe the language of the scientific materialist. But yet, brain has something very special, because there, the measurement ends. There is actually a record is made, finally. So what is so special about the brain that can do this? Now, Doug Hofstadter, who is actually a computer scientist, before then he was a physicist, but a computer scientist, he came out with a pretty good idea that can be applied here. The idea is that if you want self-reference, then you have to use a tricky kind of logic, an impossible kind of logic. He called it tangled hierarchy. I mentioned Gödel's theorem before. Gödel's theorem has this tangled hierarchy built into it. What is a tangled hierarchy? Ordinary hierarchy is called simple hierarchy because one level of the hierarchy dominates the other level, like patriarchy, matriarchy, you can think of all kinds of oligarchy. One level dominates the other. In a tangled hierarchy, both levels have causal efficacy, equal amount of causal efficacy. So in other words, it's a circular causality. And a good example of this is the liar's sentence. I am a liar. Analyze it. If I'm a liar, then I'm telling the truth. If I'm telling the truth, then I'm lying. Goes on ad infinitum. What happens? Notice that the sentence, liar's paradox, has isolated itself from the rest of the world of discourse. If you enter such a sentence, you really can go on forever with that logic. You have to deliberately make an effort of not to identify with the sentence and come out of it. So in this way, if the brain has a tangled hierarchy within it, then brain could be special. Brain is that special measurement apparatus in which once consciousness collapses it, it identifies with it. That is why in any experience, we never experience the brain. Brain is also, according to quantum physics, just an object of consciousness, object in consciousness. But when consciousness collapses the objects, we never experience the brain. In paradox of perception, you get in trouble by asking yourself, why do we perceive what we perceive? Same kind of problem. Do we have a television set and we are homunculus looking at it? This kind of dualistic picture obviously drives people crazy. But that's the only kind of way that you can make a sense of perception. Quantum physics gives you another way. The self-reference, the idea of subject and object arising together, because consciousness identifies with the brain and gets captured. Brain represents consciousness in certain way. That finally solves the problem. Subject-object split, awareness. We need to distinguish between two words. I know that in French it is difficult. I have a talk with the translators. I hope they are doing it correctly. So consciousness, undivided consciousness, that's what Freud called unconscious, unmanifest. And then there is the subject-object awareness. And that's divided, subject looking at an object. So in this way, dichotomies of psychology, unconscious-conscious, subject-object, These are the two basic dichotomies. There is another one that I want to speak about. They disappear in the quantum way of thinking. This is very good news because psychology has been enormously divided. Psychology is a science which cannot avoid talking about non-material aspects of ourselves because otherwise they have nothing to do. You cannot be a psychotherapist and only try to help people about their sensory aspects of reality. You have to got to talk about how they think, how they feel, and feeling is not included in neurophysiology, cognitive way of looking at psychology. So you bring in feeling, immediately you got to bring in other dimensions of psychology. Similarly, psychologists cannot just talk about the condition aspect of ourselves. That's behaviorism. And that can be neurophysiologically explained by neural network theory. But then we have creativity. And humanistic psychologists insist, and anybody can have experience too, because these experiences are quite common, in which we really experience a going back and forth between a higher self and the ego self. What do you make of this higher self? What to call it? Inner self, that's a concept of the spiritual tradition. I call it quantum self because quantum physics leads to such a concept. Quantum physics, the immediacy of the self, that is the result of tangled hierarchy, that certainly is a very different beast than the ego self that we experience, which has become a simple hierarchy. What makes tangled hierarchy into a simple hierarchy? Condition. How do we get condition? Well, the equations of movement that quantum physics gives for the behavior of the brain and the correlated mind with it. These quantum mechanical equations, they get modified with the feedback of memory. And that modification is a gradual one. So the more we have memory, the more we get the same stimulus and respond the same way, our responses become skewed towards responding in the way that we have responded before, which is what conditioning is about. So in this way, we can understand both of the selves and the interaction of these two selves, which what we experienced as what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the famous psychologist, called the flow experience. Many of you have experienced flow. In fact, we can experience flow right here, right now. And some of you may be doing so. A flow is the interplay between, an encounter between the quantum self and the ego. When we explain all these dichotomies, and when we include all of our experiences, we really now can apply quantum physics to our everyday life. Somebody at lunch asked me, what is the one message that you would give? And I said, I'll just give this one message. Think quantum, be creative. So let me tell you what is happening in the world of psychotherapy. In the world of psychotherapy, similarly, a paradigm shift is taking place. And one of the very nice things that is taking place is that even cognitive behaviorists are using meditation, which used to be a spiritual thing, very exclusively belonging to the people who aspire for spirituality. Not so anymore. People of every level of awareness are being taught to meditate. And I submit that meditation is a technique to make you into a quantum thinker. How does that work? What does meditation do? If all of you, I suppose, in this room have meditated, is there anybody who hasn't ever meditated? Good. Oh, one person, all right. Okay, my apologies. But if you do, you'll find that meditation is impossible when you do it the first time. Because thoughts come just, it seems like that stream of thought. They never go away. And the meditation instruction, of course, is that you meditate on a fixed thought. You eliminate all the other thoughts. And it seems like it's impossible to eliminate. But you meditate for a while, indeed it becomes quite possible. What is going on? What is going on is that you are slowing down. what happens when you are slowing down? Well, there is a gap between your thoughts. What does that mean? In quantum physics terms, there is a gap between your thoughts, meaning that you are not thinking in between. When you are not thinking, what are you? You are unconscious. Remember this concept of intermittent consciousness? We are aware only when we have an object in our awareness. When there is no subject-object split, what are we? We are not aware. We are unconscious. Our consciousness is intermittent in that sense. Awareness is intermittent. So consciousness collapses, and in between there is no awareness, only unconscious processing. Quantum objects are waves of potentiality, possibility waves. Like any other wave, the possibility waves will spread and spread and spread, becoming bigger and bigger pools of possibility to choose from. Bigger and bigger pools of possibility to choose from. Why can't we choose in our ordinary day-to-day life when we are too busy, when we are too busy being efficient? Because we let go of our choice and behave like the conditioned being that we are. But if we don't let go and learn to meditate and create gaps, then quantum possibility world will come into our thinking process. In other words, quantum thinking is fundamentally different from how we ordinarily think of thinking. Quantum thinking is thinking actively and then go passive. I call it the do-be-do-be-do process. You are alternatively doing and being. In the being mode, possibilities proliferate, becoming a reservoir of new possibilities, allowing you the privilege of creativity. Now this completely agrees with creative process that creativity researchers have discovered. Creative process consists of four stages, these theories tell us. Preparation, which everybody knows, and then they have this incubation. Bird sitting on an egg. Incubation. Identify that with unconscious processing, the way we just described it, the state of being, creating gap between thoughts, doing nothing. Possibilities proliferate, and we now can choose from a bigger pool of possibility. I will be saying a new possibility occurs, and I pick that one, and a creative insight. Discontinuity comes with discontinuity. How do we know? Because we are surprised. Aha. Aha experience. That's the normal name that psychologists give this quantum leap. Aha experience. And then we manifest it here. So in other words, creativity is guaranteed if we learn to meditate, if we slow down, if we do quantum thinking, if we combine do and be. So the psychotherapists now have a very good way of classifying people with some validity in empirical data. Obviously they send you a questionnaire and you fill it up, but there are various tests as well, and these tests confirm how you filled your car. And what they find is that there is awareness levels from 0 to all the way to 3. At the 0 level of awareness, people just blurt out whatever coming to their mind in response to a stimulus. At that level, there is hardly any freedom. This is where psychopathology is rampant, because much of our difficulty, of course, comes from this habit of blurting out. Level 1, we now have a little bit of control. Level 2, quite a bit of control. And level 3, the control is almost absolute. So with quantum physics, we can understand this now as a gradation in terms of how much quantum thinking you are capable of doing. In this way, we are combining the psychopathological with the pursuit of positive mental health. And you see clearly that psychology then is really quantum psychology, because the cognitive behavioral, the classical psychology, handles only a little spectrum of people. As I said, except for the level zero, all people have the capacity of quantum thinking. What do we do with our quantum thinking? What do we do with our creativity? Normally, people understand creativity as a way of developing products that other people will enjoy, a product in the outer arena of our life. But is this the only way that you can use creativity? Creativity, ultimately, the best kind of creativity is discovery of new meaning in a new archetypal context. So creativity is really the pursuit of archetype. This is where creativity approaches spirituality, because spirituality in some way also, as you know, is a pursuit of archetypes. Right? Archetypes like truth, beauty, love, justice, goodness, abundance, self. And you notice that our professions are more or less established in terms of the pursuit of these archetypes. Even the classical physicists, they pursue the archetype of truth, just as the psychologist pursues the archetype of self. The business person pursues the archetype of abundance. All these words have become distorted to mean, in scientific materialism, a different thing that they were supposed to mean originally. Especially the subject of abundance, for example, you know, it means only financial, monetary abundance, which is not at all the concept of abundance. So we need to redo our society. We need to redo our society, we need to redo ourselves. We need to redo ourselves with these ideas. Creative pursuit of these archetypes. So if we follow these archetypes and pursue them creatively, what we will be doing, we will be fulfilling the evolution of consciousness. We already had the morning talk, and you remember there was a little bit of evolution discussed, and evolution is evolution of consciousness. That much is very clear. We no longer need to think about evolution in terms of Darwinism. If we don't, then obviously consciousness, in other words, the potential within consciousness, that has a force that wants to express itself through evolution. So an evolution is what? Evolution is evolution of the representations of the archetypes. Archetypes can be represented in thought without us changing, but archetypes also can be represented in our life itself, in our behavior. This congruence between our thought and our behavior is, of course, what mystics mostly talk about. They talk about wholeness, where all difficulties, all suffering disappears because suffering comes from incongruence of the various aspects of our psyche. Incongruence between thoughts and feelings, incongruence between thoughts and intuitions, and etc. If we could remove this incongruence, how do we do that? We do that by pursuit of the archetype and making a direct representation of the archetype. So, the mind has been evolving. We can go into our anthropological history and we can find how the mind is evolving. Mind initially was giving meaning to the physical world. And then we graduated. Mind started giving meaning to the vital world. And we did a lot of work. This is the horticultural era of anthropology. horticulture when we were doing small-scale agriculture. Men and women were working in the fields together. And we did a lot of work on emotional totems, because emotional work requires relationship between people. We lost that when agriculture, heavy-scale agriculture was discovered, and we lost it because women could not well then plow. And so again, it becomes men's domain to earn the basic livelihood. And of course, that determines the hierarchy of the relationship. But we are now coming back again, thanks to various changes that took place in the last 400 years, coming back again to the equality of men and women. This is the time to integrate all those stuff that we haven't integrated before. This is the time to get congruence between emotions and thinking, feeling and thinking. Emotional intelligence. So that's part of it. Part of the process that we should go through in our pursuit of archetypes is, of course, a deep ecological sense with our environment. Deep ecological meaning that not only we pay attention to the outer environment, but also to the inner environment, where we live much more. We live in our mind much more than we live in the physical world. But we pay so little attention to it. So if we can start paying attention to that. The other domain, of course, is ethics. Goodness. Archetype of goodness. So, archetype of love. So we bring that up. Now, how do we pursue love truly? Here is something that quantum physics has some very definitely something to teach. Quantum relationship has to transcend locality, right? Locality is the classical relationship. So when you transcend that, bring non-locality, we get quantum relationship, the first phase. But non-locality often is not enough. It really, Ken Wilber talks about a four-quadrant consciousness, and he talks about I and we, but really, the I is joined together by non-locality becoming we is only part of the possibility. It's not far enough. But if I and you combine in a tangled hierarchical relationship, which is what our potential really demands, then it's all different. Because truly the hierarchy will be gone between you and me, and the fundamental difficulty of living in the world of ego disappears. If this could be achieved, then the whole world becomes our family. So what I'm saying is that we can talk about these things. So quantum physics, first of all, talks about individuals, creative people. Before creativity, we are not even individual. We're just repeating other people's opinions. When we become creative, we have our own opinion. First step. Second step, we discover all the archetypes. Carl Jung called this process individuation. We become individuated. But we are not satisfied. Remember those people of level zero awareness don't even have the ability of any gap whatsoever. How do we lift them up? And if we don't, it only affects our environment. We have these deranged people, pathological people running around everywhere. Why should we have to live with them, separate them, leave them out of the equation? Include them how? If we enter into a tangled hierarchical relationship with a destitute, as Mother Teresa was able to do, then we lift their consciousness up. We lift their consciousness up so much so that we become one with them, of course. And in that one consciousness, they have the gap. They have the capacity to meditate, and they have the capacity to create, and they can change too. In this way, we really can get into the heart of psychopathology and eventually make the world indeed a world of tremendous, tremendous love. Beatles were right, of course, when they wrote, "All we need is love." But the path to love is a little bit complex. Path to love requires a quantum worldview. Path to love requires understanding creativity, quantum thinking, doobie-doobie-doo, and all this. But once we do all that, it's really the potential, the future is unlimited. All day you've heard about how we can shape our future. Well, this is a very concrete way that we can picture how to shape our future. Thank you.
J'avais vu Amit Goswami est quelqu'un de particulièrement positif et optimiste. Il vous a donc, il est parti de cette constatation intéressante et forte que toute la physique quantique parle de potentialité, potentialité, potentialité. Mais qu'est-ce qui transforme ça en une actualité? Ce n'est pas la matière toute seule, a-t-il dit, ça je trouve c'est un point très fort, qui peut transformer ses potentialités en actualité. Il faut donc quelque chose de plus que la matière pour que l'actualisation se fasse. Et donc effectivement c'était son point de départ, et ensuite il est parti à un autre niveau par rapport aux autres exposés, au niveau de la créativité, et il s'est situé à deux niveaux, celui des archétypes, et ça m'a fait penser à ces grands mathématiciens qui décrivent que les mathématiques sont un continent qu'ils découvrent, et non pas quelque chose qu'ils créent dans leur cerveau. Cette créativité, cet état créatif vous met en connexion avec quelque chose d'autre, ce qu'il a appelé les archétypes, et je pense, hein, c'est une des voies qu'il a ouvertes, que justement toutes les questions de psychologie, de créativité et d'autres consistent à se mettre dans un état qui permet de recevoir cela, et c'est tout un travail. Il a montré des expériences très étonnantes à l'Université de New Mexico sur la méditation. Vous avez vu que des gens qui effectivement se mettent à méditer ensemble puis sont séparés et isolés dans des cages de Faraday sans communication, ce qui se passe sur l'un qui a un flash dans les yeux semble se répercuter sur les transférogrammes de l'autre. C'est quelque chose à analyser. Je ne connaissais pas cette expérience et je l'ai trouvée très intéressante, évidemment, comme vous certainement. Et donc à partir de cela, il a essayé de nous montrer donc que tout ce que nous discutons ici sur la physique quantique, eh bien, ça a un lien directement avec notre être, avec notre créativité, avec notre façon, hein, de percevoir le monde, et aussi de formater notre futur. Et c'était ça son message final, évidemment, la façon de mettre en place notre futur, que le futur est ouvert, justement, parce que la physique quantique nous le dit, c'est un monde de potentialité. Donc voilà maintenant. Après ces deux exposés, vous avez bien mérité une pause pendant laquelle, à l'étage en dessous, vous pourrez vous procurer, entre autres, le DVD d'Amit Goswami qui s'appelle Quantum Activist et d'autres ouvrages. Nous reprenons alors. Nous allons...